But I've used the same image in a second grade classroom, a high school classroom. My job might be called teacher, but I've come here to learn, and I'm going to learn a lot from you.
He has a challenge to all educators. Now think deeply. When you are asked to believe about every student's learning potential, finish this sentence. I believe.
And now it's time for another edulicious episode of the Bentley Brothers Podcast, bringing you what's current and what works in education. Here are your hosts, Scott and Tim Bentley.
Bentley Brothers, Bentley Brothers, bringing education information like no other. Bentley Brothers, Bentley Brothers, bringing education information like no other. Yep. First name Bentley, last name Brothers, bringing education information like no others. Yep. With Tim
and Scott. That teacher, no, that educator, that mathematician that said that is Steve Wyborney. Steve is a district math coach in Oregon, up in Eastern Oregon. In 2005, he was named the Oregon, the whole state, Teacher of the Year. Steve is also the author of 25 Common Core Math Lessons for the Interactive Whiteboard Series for grades 1 through 6, published by Scholastic. If you are interested in this series, you simply need PowerPoint and a projector in your classroom, so that's pretty handy. Steve's most recent series, Week by Week Math Review for the Digital Classroom for grades 1 through 6, was released last June. Like the earlier series, all you need is a PowerPoint and a projector. He's also got an ebook called Long Division Made Easy, an animated ebook available through Scholastic. And he recently published a book with the Teach Like a Pirate folks. Is that right, Steve?
That's right. I did.
What's the name of that book again?
So the book is called The Writing on the Classroom Wall. It is about 24 of my most passionate beliefs that I posted on the classroom wall. And the book details each one of those, but really my reflective learning journey. And I did publish that with Dave Burgess.
Great.
I think we've heard of Dave before, Tim. I don't know.
Yeah, that's awesome. How's the book doing?
You know, I think it's doing well. It's been really exciting to hear from teachers really around the world about what their beliefs are, what they've posted on the wall. How they've wrestled with, what do I really believe about teaching? What do I believe about learning? What is so important to me that I would post it on the wall of my classroom and tell my students what it means and that I would go on to learn from it? So it's been really exciting to hear from a lot of people.
So the book is not really about what you post on the wall as much as it is who you are as a teacher and your core beliefs about kids. Is that right?
Absolutely. It's about wrestling with your beliefs. What do you believe about students? What do you believe about teaching? What do you believe about learning? And it's really about the journey that you're willing to go on. And sometimes if you have a message or an idea, fleeting idea, but if you commit to it, if you post it on the wall, if you tell the students, this is what I really believe, this is what I want to learn about, it becomes public and that launches you on a journey. And it tells your students that you're really excited about learning yourself.
Steve, I kind of do that with conferences. If I want to push myself to try something new, I'll submit the idea to a conference, and then if it gets approved for me to present, I have to make sure it happens in my classroom. How else do you see teachers putting this into place just as far as the I believe statement and really putting that out there to maybe parent communities and things like that?
So, okay, one of the major themes of the book is wrestling with your beliefs about students, and I'll just tell you right off the top that what I believe about students is that students are they're absolutely amazing. They're stunning. You can't find any capacity or any the capacity to their potential, or you cannot put their potential any boundaries on it. Students are just stunning, amazing. As they learn more, their potential just continues to increase. And I knew that, I recognized that, but finally I thought, I'm just going to post that on the wall of the classroom. I'm just going to write it on the wall, put it on the wall of the classroom, and tell the students, you are absolutely incredible. You are amazing. I want you to know that every single day. Whenever I walk into the classroom, I want you to hear that from me. I also want you to know that even though I'm the teacher, I've come into the classroom to learn, and I'm here every single day to learn. And some of those particular messages are really resonating with teachers.
And I know that one of the things you recommend is that people put these messages on the like screensaver on their Apple TV. Is that right?
Oh, sure. You can post them. You can really post them anywhere. You can put it on your screensaver. You can put it on the wall. I actually brought the first one, if it's okay if I show that.
Totally. Awesome.
So what I did is the first message that I ever had was just learning is about making connections. And I wanted to learn more about what learning was. So I just printed it out on a piece of paper and posted it on the wall of my classroom. So it wasn't high tech or anything. I just publicly posted the message and then I went on to learn from it. Like, what does it mean to make connections? If a student did something in class, they came up with a novel idea, I would recognize the connection that was made and really celebrate that and prize that. And we wouldn't just try to learn about a topic. We would seek connections that maybe other people hadn't found. But it was as simple as just printing out that paper that I just showed you and posting it on the wall of the classroom. So if you don't have an Apple TV, that doesn't mean that you can't do this. You can just wrestle with it, print it on the wall and see what you learn from it.
And even if you don't have a printer, you can just grab a marker, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, excellent. Well, I'm a big fan, Steve, of you and particularly your math instruction, you know, that you, the ideas that you share out through your website. I hope that anybody that's teaching elementary school math goes to your website, stevewyborny.com. I use your stuff all the time. I'm just a big fan of it. So why don't you tell us, tell our listeners in case they're not familiar with it, what are some of the ideas, the freebies? I mean, it's all free. You're just giving these ideas away, reproducibles and things like that, that teachers can use that are really common core. They're conceptual. The kids are engaged with them. They're just powerful teaching techniques. So can you tell us about a couple of your most popular, shares that you have on your website?
Sure, absolutely. So the blog, the website is www.stevewyborny.com. And I started the blog, it's called I'm on a Learning Mission. And really, I started the blog to learn. And along the way, I wanted to find ways to give strategies away. So I started including video, and I wanted to give away lessons and resources. And it's really important to me to get things into the hands of teachers and students that are really useful. But I also learn every time I post something. I have feedback come back from teachers, and the ideas are quickly changed and transformed, and they're better than I would have originally thought. But one of the most recent posts is called Splat, and it's a post where dots just appear on the screen. I made 50 downloadable PowerPoint lessons that anybody can just take them, download them, use them in their classroom. The dots appear, the students can count how many dots there are, and then these splats appear on the screen and cover the dots. And the discourse is phenomenal. When I've been in classrooms and there might be 17 dots and three splats appear, and now you can only see four dots left. And then the question is, how many dots are under each of the splats? And they could be whole numbers, they could be fractions. But I've used the same image in a second grade classroom, a high school classroom, because in some classrooms, students will talk about remainders. In some cases, they'll talk about divisibility. There's just so much you can do with a really simple idea. So that's one of the most recent posts.
Yeah, I want you to share another one, but just before you go on, why is that so much more powerful than giving kids a page of math problems? I mean, what's the big deal about doing something like that? What happens in kids' heads? What happens in the classroom? You know, what happens in terms of communication between student and teacher and teacher and student? Why is this such a powerful way of teaching?
Okay, there are a few answers to that question. One is that this happens in a really social setting. The students are together. They see the images. And at the same time, at the same moment, that splat appears. And there's a social dynamic here. And if you look at the standards for mathematical practice, if you drill down to attend to precision, we sometimes think of that as privately attending to precision or being correct or something like that. But if you really dig into that, you're going to see that that talks about to others, with others, sharing our ideas out loud. And that's what happens with splat. There's a sudden change, and everybody sees this change at the same time, and it primes the students for discourse. And one reason that discourse is so important is that we can think that when students write, that they take an idea that exists and they just put it on paper, or when students talk, that they take an idea that they already have in mind and they just say it, but that's really not true. As students write, they're thinking more. As they talk, they're thinking more about their thoughts. So the more chances students have to produce thoughts, either through writing or speaking, the more chance that they have to think about their own thinking. And with splat, what happens is at the same time in this social setting, these splats appear and suddenly there's change and the students want to talk about it. They instantly want to talk about it. And that's why I get tweets that say, like, there's belly laughter in our classroom. Something suddenly changed and the students just want to discuss that. But it's the social setting and it's the fact that the change happens to everybody at the same time that really propels that discussion. And then you get to hear about how students see those splats in different ways. And whenever students talk, another really important dynamic that happens is that if you hear somebody talking, you're not just hearing their ideas, but you're hearing into their insights, you're hearing into their heart. And I think classrooms that are filled with language, become really powerful, not just mathematically, but in terms of a social dynamic, because students are really connecting and hearing each other's ideas. And I think that's part of what happens with SPLAT.
And it's ELD.
Absolutely.
For those kids, I mean, I found that out once I got my kids starting to talk during math, all my ELD kids, the fluency just went through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
They understand the math and they're trying to explain to somebody that's up here and they know they got to say it in English, you know, mm-hmm. and they just have the motivation all of a sudden for it. So, okay, what else is on your website that teachers might be interested in?
Okay, there's another post on there called called Tiled Area Questions. And the discourse that propels, I think, is also phenomenal. And it's sort of hiding in the shadow of SPLAT and the Fraction SPLAT series. I think because the SPLAT series has 70 downloadable lessons. But what happens with that one is the students take a shape and they decompose it into smaller squares or smaller rectangles, and they assign values based on the shape that they create. But what I've done is I've taken a shape and I've duplicated on the page 6 different times the same shape. And so students decompose the shape in 6 different ways, and they write 6 different types of equations to represent that. And in doing that, they really start to understand those equations in really new and exciting ways. There's another one called Color the Cube Connectors, and it also propels phenomenal discourse, and it also produces these beautiful artifacts of student thinking. And once the students have written down their thinking or colored it, they have a chance to say, look what I created, here's what it means. And you have all these aha moments just popping around in the classroom. So if I make something like that, I just want to share it. I just want to give it away. So those are a few things on the site.
Super cool. Hey, Steve, should we be using manipulatives more?
You know, I think every grade level should be using manipulatives. So kindergarten, fourth grade, 12th grade. If you're in high school, manipulatives are just a tool for thinking. And I don't think there's a place for not using manipulatives when you need access to a thinking tool. I think we should always have those within reach. I don't see a place where we would ever like completely take manipulatives off the shelf. I think any thinking tool, whether it's manipulatives or pencil, paper, whatever it might be, we want to have that in reach for the students so that they can personally make meaning, but also so that they can share their ideas. If I build something with manipulatives, not only have I thought about it, but you can see what I've built. And that's really important in communicating our mathematical thinking. So I'd say, yes, absolutely. Use manipulatives all the time.
Can you kind of take us inside the classroom of maybe a teacher that you've seen in your district or something you've done with kids with manipulatives that perhaps some of our teachers might not have thought about doing with manipulatives? I know that I've just in the last couple of years, I mean, I'm in my 29th year of teaching, and I feel like I'm just getting started learning how to teach math. And I've seen what some of these teachers are doing with manipulatives, and it's just been invigorating. You know, it's like an eye opener. So can you share with us maybe one or two quick things that teachers are using manipulatives for?
Okay, sure. Here's a quick idea that I think I've shared with several people. Just take a number line and strip the numbers off of it. So you just have a number line that's numberless, and then put some markers on it. So maybe you have a 0 on the number line, and then a little bit to the right of it, put a red marker, and a little farther to the right of it, put a blue marker, and then say, where would the red plus blue, if you added the red to the blue, and let's call that green, where would that green marker be? Or if you had blue minus red, or if you divided one by the other, or something like that. And if you try to ask those questions without manipulatives, students aren't going to be able to access some of those concepts. But the moment you put that down as a manipulative, then students can start to move that around and think about that. I think that can be really powerful. Another one is to just give students simple squares, like tile squares, and have them build shapes with particular perimeters or areas, and tell them that every one of the squares has a certain value. Like say that you have a shape with an area of 7 and every square in there has a value of 1. You could say, what is the total area? Or what if the area that if every tile had a value of 5, what would the total area be? Or what if every tile had a value of 1/3, what would the total be? And by having those manipulatives in front of you, it allows you as a teacher to ask increasingly advanced questions. And so I see a lot of great use of manipulatives. I don't think you would ever want to say, here are some manipulatives, this is what you do with them. But I think that you can use manipulatives to leverage a lot of really good opportunities.
Yeah, Steve, I had a question about questions. What's something that we could do to promote more questioning in kids when they're thinking about math? Because a lot of times I think kids come in and they want to just be taught and given the, you know, the algorithm, and but I want them asking the questions. So you've given a couple of good ways to talk about it. Is there anything that I can do to make sure I'm promoting question asking through that process?
Okay, sure. That's a really good question. So one of the things as teachers that we know is really important is we have to sort of remove ourselves from the equation in a lot of situations. Whereas it might be easy to think, I'm the teacher, I'm going to come in and teach a lesson and the students are going to learn. But sometimes in doing that, we can talk a lot and we need to remove our voice from the conversation quite a bit so that the students can insert their voice. And we need to take our teacher answers out of the conversation so that the students can arrive at their questions. And sometimes we can pose a question and then right away pose an answer to the question. And that's not going to benefit the students at all. What it'll teach them is that my teacher is going to give me a question, that my teacher is going to tell me how to solve it, and then life will come and my teacher won't be there. What we want to do is have interesting scenarios that invite wondering and allow the students to really wonder and ultimately arrive at questions. And if the end of the lesson comes and we haven't found an answer to that question, I think that's great. I think that's phenomenal. I would love to end a lesson with a question rather than an answer almost any single day. And so sometimes what we have to do is present interesting scenarios, but then just sort of step out. Don't insert our own thinking into it. Give the students a chance to wonder and question and arrive at those things.
And what you're saying, Steve, I think is something that Scott and I are really into, and that's just developing the character of our kids before we're developing the content. Because what you're talking about is that we need to have kids that have the character to wonder, to pursue, to persevere, to interact with these ideas. And if the kids don't have that, it doesn't really matter what the content is that we're teaching them, right?
Absolutely. That belief in themselves is really, really important. So the grit, the determination, the resilience, but then also understanding that my teacher deeply believes in me is also very important, because the beliefs that we have about our students can quickly become adopted by our students. So if I walk into classroom every day and I say, girls, boys, before we start this lesson, there are a few things that I want you to know. One is that I absolutely believe in you. You are stunning. You are amazing. You are astonishing. Before we talk about any content at all, I want to talk about you. You are absolutely incredible. It is a privilege to be in your presence. I'm happy to be here today. My job might be called teacher, but I have come here to learn, and I'm going to learn a lot from you. And I think that's a really good way to start the day. That comes from me wholeheartedly every time I step up to teach a lesson. I think that's a lot more important than whatever content we might cover that day.
That's beautiful.
And we all want to feel valued. And when our students feel valued and their ideas and their questions feel valued, it's just that's a different climate that's created inside your classroom for sure.
Mm-hmm. And so, sometimes we have to wade through those really uncomfortable moments where we feel like maybe the students have arrived at an answer, but there's something deeper and richer beyond that. So we just have to say, I wonder what else, or what else do we notice, or what else could there be to this? And there might be some very uncomfortable wait time. We may not know what questions to ask, but our students are absolutely incredible. And if we give them time and space to arrive at some of those questions, they will absolutely come through. And sometimes we feel rushed, like we need to get to the next thing, when sometimes what we need to do is take our concern about where we need to go off the table and let the students investigate some of those questions.
Do I give up on the pacing guides? Do I give up on the getting through all the content that I'm supposed to get through in a year? I mean, because if you're giving the time necessary, you might have kids do it, like get there really fast on different things and get to high levels more quickly than others. How do we do that in this test-driven, content-driven system that we really have out there?
Okay, what a really great question. So I'm a K-12 math coach, and I work with teachers. You know, I'll see students travel through the kindergarten year, then the first grade year, the second grade year, and I become keenly aware that if a student doesn't complete the pacing guide at the kinder level, then they're going to have significant holes at the end of that year. If they don't finish the pacing guide at the fourth grade level, then they're going to walk into fifth grade automatically with some holes. And so the pacing guide, it's really important to keep going on the pacing guide. But what I think else is really important is to really internalize that pacing guide and look at the whole scope of the curriculum. So as a fifth grade teacher, what is it that I really need to cover during this year? and then teach very, very opportunistically. So say you're in chapter two or unit two, but you see an opportunity to connect something with from chapter 8, chapter 10, and chapter 12, make those connections, pull those things together. I know that we can, when we build pacing guides, sometimes we break things apart to make sense of them, but really math is, it's about making connections. And so I think if we see opportunities to guide students in the direction where they can start to authentically create some of those questions, that's really useful. But it's hard to do if you're following the pacing guide week by week by week by week, then you fall behind, the pressure from the testing comes and all of that. But if you can see all that's coming and find a way to really create rich connections, I think you can actually move through it fairly quickly. I know it's a major significant challenge, but I would say teach opportunistically. Look down the road, look for opportunities to tie things together, and then take those opportunities.
That's some great advice. I just want to go back to what you were saying about kids just blowing you away, you know, and coming up with stuff that you don't expect out of them. I was actually doing cube connectors with my kids yesterday, and I said, what if you, instead of making, you know, equations where you're treating each block as a whole number, I said, what if you dealt with this whole shape that you're looking at as one whole, and then the cubes are a fraction of the whole? How could you make some equations using fractions? And I'm thinking like, okay, they're going to color in 8 out of the 24 and call that a third of the shape, right? Well, one of my kids gets up and he puts his paper under the document camera, good old Johnny, one of my awesome kids. And what he did was he colored in a fraction of the cubes, like a single cube. So he actually split the cube and colored in half of the cube as red and the other half as yellow. And I'm like, oh my goodness, this guy's like, I didn't expect you to do something that crazy.
So then you start seeing things like students are multiplying fractions by fractions, or in some cases, they're dividing fractions by fractions. Then as a teacher, you might think, well, that's not something that I'm coming to for a little while, but you're going to take that opportunity and pull it in there and share that with other students. So yeah, students stun you combined with teaching opportunistically in that social setting. I think it's a really good.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, that happens when you put the kids in charge and you put them up in the front of the room and you have them sharing instead of the teacher being the blah, blah, blah the whole time, you know? So Steve, we're going to shift gears with you right now, if you don't mind. We understand that you're into geocaching. Is that right?
That is. I do that during the summer times. I don't get to cache much during the school year, but I do enjoy it in the summer.
Oh, all Steve, right. you got to build that into some lessons.
We Absolutely.
Do geocaching lessons, and it's a lot of fun. You got to try that one out.
Cool. So today we're going to see how much you know about your hobby by playing a little game that we're going to call Geo Cash In. Got to have you cash in on some big winnings for one of our lucky listeners. Okay, Scott, so why don't you tell our audience who Steve's going to be competing for today?
Steve, you will be competing for Amanda Glover, a fifth grade teacher in Florida. If you're able to answer 2 out of 3 questions, yes, 66% correct, Amanda will be awarded a free download of the album of the ridiculously popular edgy rock band Rockin' the Standards.
Okay, I'm ready. Amanda, I will do my best.
Steve, would you like to, this is a little impromptu here, would you like to give away one of your books instead of doing a Rockin' the Standards song?
Absolutely, I would love to.
Okay, so you want to give Amanda, if you can answer these correctly, Amanda.
Oh, let's give her like some Rockin' the Standards stuff too, man.
Okay,
let's pile it on.
She's going to win your latest book, and she's going to win a Rockin' the Standards album at the same time if you can answer 2 out of these 3 questions correctly. So the pressure is really on now. All right, so our first question. Up in the state of Washington, kind of near you up there, someone found a bicycle while geocaching. That's not the crazy part. What's so crazy about the bicycle that they found while geocaching? Is it A?
There was a human skeleton on the bicycle. That would be crazy.
Or is it B?
The bike was gift wrapped and hidden beneath a barn. That would be crazy.
Or behind a barn, yes. Or is it C?
The rusty bicycle was lodged up in the crotch of the tree, several feet off the ground? That would be crazy. Who writes these things?
You have 3 choices, Steve. human skeleton on the bicycle, gift wrapped bicycle, or it was lodged in the crotch of a tree.
You know, I have never heard this story, but I enjoyed hearing those answer possibilities quite a bit. Wow, I need to go find this geocache up in Washington. So I'm just going to have to take a shot in the dark. I'm going to say that the bicycle was up in the tree.
That is correct. Good job. The bicycle is actually like the tree was like growing around the bicycle. It's like just.
Are you sure this was actually planted cache, Tim?
No, I don't understand geocaching myself, but
that one was years in the making.
Yes, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So question number two, one geocacher found a very out of place object in a forest. Was it A,
full size regulation parking meter?
Or was it B,
a brand new moped?
Or was it C,
a urinal like you'd find in a public bathroom attached to a tree?
Wow, it could be any of those. I found some pretty crazy geocaches. I think the one that sounds like it might be pretty odd would be to find a parking meter in the middle of the forest. So it could be any of them, but I'm going to try out the parking meter. Amanda, I hope I'm right.
And Steve! It was a full-size regulation parking meter out in the middle of a forest. That would be very strange to see in a forest, all right?
Hey, you're going to get to go for 100%. It's been a while since we've had a three out of three.
These are hard questions, too. All right, number three. Sometimes geocachers can make a difference in somebody's life. And I'm sure you have already made a difference in many people's lives. And so which of these is the true story of a geocache Good Samaritan? Is it A?
Two geocachers found a cat who was trapped in a tree. And not only did they climb the tree to save the cat, but they also searched up the cat's owner using the cat's tag and arranged to get that cat home.
Or is it B?
One very giving geocacher chased down and apprehended a robber who was hiding in a barn near the location of his cache.
Or is it C?
Four geocachers found a woman who had been trapped in her SUV for 14 hours. They're credited with saving her life, Steve.
So you have three choices there. We've got the cat in the tree that was saved. We have apprehending a robber. Or we have finding a woman that was trapped for 14 hours in her SUV. Which one do you think?
You know, I wouldn't be surprised if all of those were true, but I'm going to go with the lady who was trapped in the car.
They saved a woman's life. She was trapped there for 14 hours. Can you imagine? Woo! So, Scott.
Wait, Tim, why didn't she just unlock the door and leave?
Because she was trapped.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Okay. So, Scott, how did Steve do today?
Good job, Steve. You got three out of three correct. That's good enough to be a winner.
Woo!
Congratulations. You won absolutely nothing. But Amanda down in Florida, she just won your awesome book and Rockin' the Standards album. Tim, double up prize today with Steve. This is awesome.
This is awesome. So thank you, Steve, for being a good sport and being so good at your hobby, geocaching, that you can get 100% on that. Can you tell our listeners how they can get a hold of you and follow up and learn more? I've already mentioned your website. Maybe you can give us your Twitter handle or any other ways of learning more about what you're teaching and learning with us.
Sure. I'd encourage you to go to the website, which is www.stevewyborny.com, or contact me on Twitter. My handle is @SteveWyborny. I love to communicate with educators all throughout the world. And so I try to find educators, follow educators. If we're following each other, we can send each other direct messages and just talk about math or teaching. So Twitter is a great place to find me.
Yeah, and it's WYBORN, like born. Is that right? Yeah, EY. EY on the end.
That's
just
right.
All right. So thanks again, Steve. And Scott, you want to share a little quick something about our biggest passion?
Tim, I love, by the way, having the good guys in education out there coming on the show like Steve. Hey, everybody, if you have not gone to www.globalschoolplayday.com and signed your class up for 2018, you better be playing this week then. We're counting on you. We need you out there giving these kids a chance to have some unstructured playtime that builds compassion and empathy and creativity and all these things. We need you to share that out. We're going for 500,000 in the fourth year, which is 2018. Last year, Tim, we had over a quarter of a million kids from over 50 nations around the world participating on the first Wednesday in February, Global School Play Day, just to say to the world, hey, unstructured play for kids is really vital to their healthy development.
And we do want to thank all of our listeners for listening and participating and sending us tweets and for doing the reviews on iTunes. That really helps to drive traffic to the show. And so more educators can get the ideas that we're sharing. Thanks so much again, Steve.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks, Tim.
All righty. And thanks for watching.
Mom and Dad.
Mom and Dad.
Bedley Brothers. Bedley, Bedley Brothers. Bringing education information like the author. Bedley Brothers. Bedley, Bedley Brothers.